If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Friday, July the 19th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, a Hoover Institution Research Fellow and Hoover's Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism. My guest today in our studio here on the campus of Stanford University is Scott Atlas. Scott Atlas, actually it's Dr. Scott Atlas, MD, is the Hoover Institution's David and Joan Traitel Senior Fellow, as well as a member of Hoover's Working Group on Healthcare Policy. His job, quite simply, is to investigate the impact of government and the private sector on access, quality, pricing, and innovation in healthcare. He's the author of several books on healthcare reform, including 2016's Restoring Quality Healthcare, a six-point plan for comprehensive reform at lower cost. You can find that via Hoover Press. Dr. Atlas has advised members of Congress and the current administration on healthcare, which, if you haven't guessed by now, is the topic of this podcast. Scott, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here, Bill.
You came to Hoover, actually you made kind of a lateral move across the campus, so in terms of moving it wasn't that long, but you came to us from Stanford University's Medical Center, where you're a professor and chief of neuroradiology for the better part of about 15 years. Why did you shift over to the Ivory Tower, and also why would you rather be doing academia than actually practicing medicine?
Well, my career actually was 100% academic medicine, but that involved research, teaching, and clinical care. I moved over because it became very clear that healthcare policy was on the table and very, very important, particularly because of the push under President Obama toward more government control. And the second reason was that it was obvious that healthcare was very poorly understood by people on both sides of the policy aisle. Mm-hmm. Whether or not they wanted more government control, less government control, there was very little understanding. And in fact, I find even in the policy world of very, very knowledgeable healthcare economists, there's a lack of understanding of how healthcare is delivered, the lack of understanding of the importance of technology, the lack of understanding of tertiary care medicine, and actually all these things underlie the reasons why American medical care is the world's best medical care and why healthcare in general has advanced over the past half century.
If I were to ride my bicycle past the university medical complex and I saw six MDs sitting on a park bench and they were talking about healthcare reform, Scott, what do you think they'd be talking about?
Most doctors, if I can generalize, talk more about their personal experience than the general issues. And their personal experience is really based upon a tremendous amount of frustration with the increasing bureaucracy, the increasing time spent on administrative tasks, billing, coding for so-called reimbursement, which in and of itself is sort of a bizarre concept. And less about the politics. Now, there are people, of course, in medicine who are concerned about the politics, and we read all the time, and Obama actually paraded a bunch of doctors in white coats in front of him during the Affordable Care Act and boasted about the AMA's position supporting it. But, of course, the reality that no one understands is that the AMA represents less than 20% of American doctors. So there's a wide range of opinions about the way healthcare should go if you look at the medical profession. But the majority are, in fact, opposed to Obamacare. And the majority of doctors are more than that focused on their own frustration with the profession evolving into a more bureaucratic, more structured, more intrusively changed system where the relationship and the autonomy of patients with their doctors has been really minimized.
There have been two political stories this week, Scott, the first one being President Trump and the AOC squad, the war of words between the two, Trump telling them to get out of the country, and they're pushing back very hard. The other story, which came out later this week, is the luck of the draw for the next Democratic debate at the end of the month. Interesting enough, Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden will not be on the same stage. He and Elizabeth Warren will be on a different night than Biden. And that's a shame, because if not for the AOC Trump spat this week, we'd be talking a lot more about Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden. In this regard, the former vice president came out with a health care plan earlier this week. And Biden, who clearly is trying to play to the middle, he's thinking about the general election, he's thinking about how to win back states in the Midwest. He would not buy into Medicare for all, but he did buy into what he calls a public option. He trotted out, we can't call it son of, I guess it's not politically correct, but it's a spinoff, if you will. It's Obamacare 2.0. In his way of thinking things. You wrote a column for the Wall Street Journal about this, about Biden and the public option, and you're not a fan of what he proposed. Why?
Well, Biden didn't quite back off of single payer for all. He says he backs off of single payer for all, but in fact, his proposal ultimately ends up as single payer for all or nearly all. And that is this so-called public option. And just to kind of say it in one sentence, a single payer option, a public option, is not a moderate compromise proposal at all. Right. In fact, its inevitable consequence is the death of affordable private health insurance. Now, why do I say that? And this is really sort of a little bit more complicated than the very simple slogan of the Bernie Sanders type, which is, oh, government health care free and guaranteed. That's very easy to digest and understand, although it's a complete fallacy. The public option leads to essentially elimination of private health insurance for all because of a few things. Number one, public options, public health care is essentially, it crowds out, it replaces private health care by the factual data. When it's been tried, and in fact, it was tried in the United States in Hawaii about a decade ago, and over 80%, in fact, something like 85% of those who took up the public option were already insured by private health insurance. So what that did was that instead of paying for themselves, they shifted their burden to the general population of taxpayers.
Right.
They went to the public option. Now, why is that so bad? Well, I mean, first of all, we know from the data that public insurance is much worse than private insurance. We know from the factual data, and I'll go into that in a second. But what that shift does, it doesn't just burden the taxpayer. It makes private health insurance unaffordable because that shift goes into insurance that doesn't just pay less than private insurance to doctors and hospitals. It pays less than the cost of giving the care. The most recent data for Medicare in the United States is that 87% of the cost is paid back by the insurer. Okay, so the old joke is you lose money per widget, but you make up for it in volume. No, obviously. So you go bankrupt if you end up using public insurance. So how do you avoid going bankrupt as a doctor or a hospital? By being paid less than it costs you to deliver the good or service, meaning the medical care. You avoid it by taking what you need to make and adding it to the people with private insurance. And so that is a cycle. The more people that opt for the cheaper public insurance, and I'll tell you why it's cheaper in a second, the more people that opt for the public insurance, the more the burden shifts toward private insurance, the more explosive the premiums go up for private insurance, the less affordable the private insurance. The only people who can afford private insurance are the more affluent people. And for a party whose main message is getting rid of the so-called inequality in American society, you are generating and creating and doubling down and worsening a difference in the healthcare quality and access from rich and poor by doing that. So, I mean, this is a real problem that people don't understand, and except those like the Representative Ocasio-Cortez, who said the other day, well, so what? So you get rid of private insurers. We're not in the business. Basically, her point was, We don't care about supporting private insurers. Okay, that isn't the point. The point about this is that when you let private insurers go out of business, you don't just create an option only the best option of private healthcare for the richer people.
Right.
But what happens? Why is public insurance cheaper? It's cheaper because there are overt restrictions on healthcare. Mm-hmm. You have less access to drugs, less access to medical technology, longer waits for appointments with doctors, unconscionable waits for specialists, delays in getting surgery. Well, why do I say that? Because we know it's proven. We look at all the healthcare systems that are single-payer nationalized systems all over the world with decades and decades of experience. We're talking about 50, 60 years. NHS in England is the classic example. And we know these things occur, but you would say, okay, well, so what? So what? So they wait longer. Well, the answer, what is the consequence? The consequence is worse healthcare outcomes from every serious disease compared to the United States system. Worse outcomes from cancer, heart disease, stroke. Every single major medical disease, high blood pressure and diabetes, worse outcomes by the medical journal data. That means more people die, more people have pain and suffering, more people have disabilities. And of course, the purpose of health policy reform is not to go right toward a worse system.
Right. So we're doing a podcast, so the listeners visually can't see this, but I'm flashing you right now my little Stanford Healthcare Alliance card. You and I are Stanford University employees, and we belong to the Healthcare Alliance. Mine happens to say Aetna on it. If Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden, one of these Democrats who is in favor of public option or Medicare for all, Scott, if they actually come to power with a Democratic Congress and they can change this and put this into play, what happens to this little card of mine? Is there still an Aetna to be had, or do I get a little government card? How does the system work?
Well, I would say this. The first thing is that it's probably true. I would say highly, highly unlikely that there will be an outlawing of private insurance, an overt outlawing. Americans will not stand for that because amidst all the nuanced arguments, and we can talk about how complicated it is, 180 million people in the United States have private insurance. And
right,
it's not going to, that's a political loser to just forbid it. I can't believe that's going to happen. So what?
Kamala Harris learned this lesson the hard way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, they go in and out of it. I mean, they're. Right. I'm not a political consultant, but they have to win the primary before they can run for president. So
correct,
there's different things set. In any event, the public option or opening up Medicare or lowering the age for Medicare eligibility, this kind of transformation that will occur in America's healthcare will have less and fewer and fewer people with private insurance options. So, yeah, people will have, I mean, if what they are pushing comes to fruition, people will have Medicare. Mm-hmm. Taxes will skyrocket. Now, why will they skyrocket? Well, we know that for California alone, single-payer health care is estimated to cost $400 billion a year, more than twice the state's annual budget.
Right.
National estimates, $32, $40 trillion of Medicare for all. But Bernie Sanders sort of has a point that I do want to acknowledge, and that is that he's right that the argument shouldn't be about cost. Taxes will necessarily go way up. That's clear. But the overall cost of single-payer systems, by the data, mm-hmm, is less than the cost that Americans spend on healthcare. So your ultimate payment for healthcare would, in theory, be less. But, you know, why is that? Because you get less use of healthcare.
Right.
Because you're not allowed to use healthcare because the payer forbids it. And so you get those outcomes that I mentioned. But what will happen is that, you know, more and more people will have this government-run healthcare program. And then you'll have trouble, for instance, finding doctors. How do I know that? Because we know right now that more than half of doctors do not accept new Medicaid patients. And about half of doctors who signed a contract with the government to accept new Medicaid patients, about half of them do not accept new Medicaid patients. How do I know that? Because that's the Department of HHS data itself. Mm-hmm. I got that data from them. This is not just a rant. This is fact. And so what happens is you end up getting doctors you end up getting restricted networks or providers, hospitals and doctors that accept your new insurance. And sort of this goes to another point I would like to make, which is people have to understand, saying you're insured, labeling someone as insured, does not mean you have access to medical care. And this is one of what I found really personally offensive parts of Obamacare, of the Affordable Care Act. It's unconscionable to celebrate expanding insurance, meaning the Medicaid expansion, and celebrating that when there's two other factors. That doesn't mean that these people get access to medical care. So that's a fraud. Mm-hmm. And the second point is there's not a single person in Congress who voted for the Medicaid expansion who would accept that for them or their own family. And that to me is really a heinous, heinous indictment of our politicians.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. Scott, there was a piece in the publication The Hill earlier this week, and it reports that Senate Republicans are now looking at drafting an Obamacare replacement. Why is this news? Because Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has made it clear throughout 2019 that health care reform is off the table with his caucus. Why? The leader says we're not going to engage in this because why do it? Because it's a Democratic House. We're just not going to get anywhere on it. But now apparently Senate Republicans have changed their mind because they're thinking about what happens if a lawsuit does actually strike down Obamacare, if a court declares it unconstitutional. Republicans are now faced with the question of what do you do in the way of a replacement? And we've seen this movie before. We saw this in 2017, where Republicans spent about 7 months trying to pass an Obamacare repeal and replacement. John McCain famously walks down to the floor of the Senate, gives the thumbs down, and kills it on the Senate side. It was a mess for Republicans. They differed over capping Medicaid funding. You got into this full-blown argument over full repeal versus skinny repeal. But let's do Leader McConnell a favor on this podcast, Scott, and let's push him in the right direction as to what to do. And you're best suited to do this because why? You wrote a column for the Wall Street Journal, October the 3rd, 2017, the headline, "The Healthcare Reform That Hasn't Been Tried." You laid out three principles for healthcare reform. I'm going to read the principles to you, and I want you to explain what they are. Number one, first principle, equip consumers to consider prices. What does that mean, equip consumers to consider prices?
Well, we have a system. Medical care in the United States is probably the only good or service that is used, meaning bought, without knowing what it's priced at. Now, why is that? Because there's this impression that, quote, someone else is paying. And so why would you ask? And in fact, most people don't ask what the price is when you go in for medical care. And so we need to equip consumers with the means to we need to equip them with the idea that they should care about price. And therefore, we have to motivate them to care about price. You have to give them a reward for spending less money. That's called an incentive to care about price, just like we have in every other good or service. You don't walk in and buy a cell phone and not ask, oh, what does this cost? Why not? Why don't you do that? Because you're paying. And so in healthcare, because you assume you're not paying, even though indirectly, of course, we're all paying, someone else is paying, and our system has evolved to minimize the direct payment by the patient, minimize out-of-pocket. Insurance now is moving and has moved more and more toward paying essentially everything, low deductibles, and minimal co-payments. And this is a real problem because it leads to overuse of healthcare and not caring about the price. So when I say equip consumers, it means both incentivize them to care, and then you must give them the vehicles to have the money to pay directly. Mm-hmm. And how do we do that? There are two main components of that. The first is we want to position patients to pay directly at the point of service. And that means on the spot. And that is not accomplished if insurance pays everything. So you have to allow, deregulate, roll back these Obamacare and decades, really, of regulations that have prevented higher deductible insurance from being available to everyone.
Right.
And why is higher deductible insurance necessary? Because you pay up to the limit of the deductible. Now, the reason why higher deductible insurance would be valued by people is that it's cheaper. In the pre-Obamacare regulatory morass, higher deductible insurance policies were much cheaper. And so how would you pay, you might ask, for these pre-insurance bills when you buy healthcare at the point of service? And the way you pay is that you would pay by having very large and liberalized use health savings accounts. That's one way you would pay. And this is one of the other parts of my proposal. What do I mean by larger? Well, right now, you could immediately double health savings accounts, which are sort of like IRAs that are used only for healthcare.
Right.
You could double them to the maximums to the maximum out of pocket allowed, for instance. And because, of course, when you don't have insurance, you need the money to pay for it. But again, the insurance is, in theory, much cheaper when it's higher deductible. And, of course, getting rid of these bloated policies, this idea that mandated coverage for everything from wigs, acupuncture, marriage counseling. These are things, in vitro fertilization, that most people don't use and would never pay for if they didn't have to pay for it. With mandated coverage. So the insurance becomes cheaper, and you get a very cheap policy for what insurance was always intended to be, which is catastrophic, unexpected expenses.
Your second point in the column was, quote, work strategically to increase the supply of medical services to stimulate competition. Let me repeat that. Work strategically to increase the supply of medical services to stimulate competition. Sounds like you're saying we have to find ways to drive down the price of services.
Well, the price, it's exactly right. The price of services and any good or service in the United States is driven down by sellers competing for the buyer's money. If we position patients to be the buyer and therefore and also care about saving money, then we, of course, must have a situation where there are multiple places to buy the good or service. You can't have what is the situation today where, in fact, there are many obstacles, anti-consumer, anti-competitive obstacles that have been perpetuated and also actively put into place by the medical profession. And so right away we know, for instance, there's been a long-held knowledge of a doctor shortage in the United States. Both primary care and surgeons and other specialists.
This is not just a rural problem. This is a national problem?
National problem. Data documented in the AMA data. Projections have been visible for many, many years about this. And what has been done? Well, very little. In fact, nothing. The number of medical school graduates has plateaued for the past 40 years. There is an excruciating process limiting the number of specialists trained that is sort of lobbied held in place by organizations that are sort of run by the MD profession. So here's the solution, and the solutions are many. Number one, right off the bat, we know that we're in an era of telemedicine, distance medicine.
Right.
Yet medical MD licensing in the United States is the kind of holding of every state. If you're living in Pennsylvania as a doctor, you have a Pennsylvania license to practice. If you want to practice in New York, you have to get a state license in New York. And if you want to practice across the country by distance, by computer, which is, of course, much cheaper and adds competition, which is the whole point, we need to abolish this restrictive state-by-state licensing. That's from a different era. That's really obsolete, archaic, and there's no reason other than the entrenched bureaucracy and constraining competition to have that. The second big point in primary care, we know the data, and the data is the following. Nurse practitioners and physician assistants can deliver what I call simple primary care. And of course, I always get pushback from doctors on this, but I'm a doctor too. I understand what simple primary care is. You don't need an MD training to diagnose somebody with the flu, to do prescriptions, to manage high blood pressure, to take to give annual vaccinations. These kinds of things are simple care that can be done by nurse practitioners and physician assistants right. at half the price. How do I know that they can do them? Because the data has proven it. We have studies that show that the outcomes from nurse practitioners and physician assistants who are today constrained unnecessarily by in practice rules, the outcomes are just as good. And in fact, patient satisfaction at these outpatient clinics is very high because these outpatient clinics are not just cheaper, but even when they're fully covered by insurance and patients aren't considering the money, they're highly satisfactory because they're local, the hours are very convenient. Mm-hmm. It's a lot quicker than going into either a doctor's office or an emergency room. And these are all things that would improve access and much cheaper competition for primary care. And how do I know it's a good thing? Because doctors are very much against it because they're against their monopolistic practice from mm-hmm. being intruded on. We can also do the same with specialty training programs. I sort of alluded to this, but we need to at least get this out in the public sphere that there is an aggressive restriction of training programs of specialists, even though we know, and the doctors know, that there is a dramatic shortage of doctors in these areas.
Right.
So we have that has to be abolished. You know, all these things, including everything that can add to the competition here, it works in every other good or service. That's why your iPhone in your pocket, which is really sort of a supercomputer, doesn't cost $20,000.
Right. Right. Is there also a malpractice component to that? Because it occurs to me, so I had the flu earlier this year, and I went over to my provider, and I had a nurse basically do about 95% of the work. She checked my temperature, she looked at my symptoms, she went through my history, and the doctor sashayed in about 10 minutes after she checked me out and looked me over for about 30 seconds and said, "Yeah, you got the flu." Thank you very much, doctor. But I ask this question, Scott, because if I were in a situation where I went in with the flu, but actually there was something much more wrong with me, and an RN and LPN checked me out and said, "You just have the flu, be on your way." If a doctor, if an MD didn't check me out, would I then have grounds for a lawsuit saying that my provider was negligent?
Well, I mean, this is sort of a complicated question
you hear about malpractice having to be some component of healthcare reform at some point.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I'm not, by the way, I just want to sort of reel back a little bit to the idea of getting rid of unnecessary practice constraints on nurses and nurse practitioners.
Right.
I'm not saying all. I'm not saying that all of a sudden that everybody should be able to do office surgical procedures and other things.
No.
And there are certainly necessary oversights by doctors on these things, but there's big room for a reducing price, and there's some unnecessary practice constraints. Now, in terms of malpractice, yes, I mean, this is a big issue in the United States. We live in a very litigious society. And although the data is sort of difficult to tease out, because there are some studies that say, oh, malpractice costs are only a very small contributor to the costs of medicine. Mm-hmm. But when you look at it a different way, and this has been done, including by one of my colleagues, Dan Kessler, but many other people, you see that a tremendous amount of medicine is what's called defensive medicine. And what that is extra tests, redundant tests, all kinds of duplicative tests are ordered because it's sort of a CYA, cover your parentheses behind,
right.
Way to practice medicine, because malpractice is sort of a way of American life. If you look at countries, malpractice, the United States sort of stands out in terms of how often doctors are sued. And this system has to be reformed. There's a certain amount of reform that could be done in malpractice litigation in terms of pain and suffering versus actually sort of these other massive awards that are given by juries mm-hmm. Out of vague ideas. So I think there's a way to reform malpractice, perhaps with using expert panels rather than laymen to decide these kinds of awards.
Okay, the third principle that you laid out in your column was introduce the right incentives into the tax code.
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of an esoteric thing, but people have to realize that the tax code, the way it sets right now, was sort of an accident of history. And that is that there is sort of unlimited tax deduction or income exclusion for employer-provided health benefits, which in the United States, employer-provided health benefits are the majority of health care. And when we look at that sort of a situation where whatever you get for money for health care benefits is excluded, is tax preferred, that makes every dollar that you spend on health care worth more than a dollar you'd spend on something else. And that is a tax, an inadvertent tax incentive to spend more on health care. And so that feeds into this idea of healthcare prices are higher, more and more healthcare is used because your dollar is more valuable when it's spent on that. It's a very bad, counterproductive, harmful system, and that has to be stopped. And there are various ways to stop that. I mean, I'm for capping that sort of income exclusion. We also need to level the playing field. We need to have self-employed people have the same tax benefits, whatever they are, as people that are employed at large firms that give health benefits, et cetera. So there's counterproductive parts of our system right now, including all the things that we've mentioned, really, that add up to this kind of unintended consequence of increasing the price of health care. And the point of all this is the real way to get health care available at high quality to everybody in society is not to subsidize health insurance, which is what the Democrats did under Obamacare and what the Republicans often propose in their reform plans, because all you're doing is subsidizing the wrong kind of insurance. You're propping up and furthering the hidden prices of medical care. What we want to do, the basic point, is to reduce the price of medical care itself, because that is the determinant of the price of insurance. That is why health care access is restricted, even for people on government programs. The cheaper the cost of medical care, the better access there is to medical care. And so if you get it down by competition, we know in America that competition reduces prices and optimizes value and therefore increases quality. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you just go top down and fix the price of something, you dry up the availability of the good and you harm quality.
You may not remember the movie many, many years ago, Trading Places, with Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy. And Eddie Murphy plays a street con who ends up inside a very swank little private men's club in Philadelphia. And the cops have him at gunpoint and he yells out, "Is there a lawyer in the house?" And all these gentlemen turn their backs to him. Scott Atlas, MD, if you went to a joint session of Congress and you asked, "Is there a doctor in the house?" How many hands do you think would go up in the air?
Well, I have spoken to actually the group of doctors. Yes. There is a sort of a group of doctors.
There is. Let us go through the numbers. This is according to Patients Action Network, Scott. 16 members of Congress are physicians. That includes 13 in the House and the three senators. Those three senators are?
Go ahead, fill in.
Okay. They're all Republicans, actually. So John Barrasso from Wyoming, who is an orthopedic surgeon. Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, who is a gastroenterologist, and Rand Paul from Kentucky, who is an ophthalmologist. I did a little homework on this. This is interesting, actually. The last four sessions of Congress, Scott, the age of Congress has pretty much remained the same. 57 years old is the median age in the House, 62 in the Senate. There are 145 lawyers in the House versus three MDs in the Senate, 47 lawyers in the Senate. So there is a huge disparity between lawyers and doctors here. The dominant professions in Congress are, not surprisingly, public service, politics, business, law. There are as many veterinarians in the House of Representatives, Scott, as there are physicians. There are twice as many ordained ministers in the House as there are physicians. I mention this because the mark of any good physician is bedside manner and the ability to how to explain disease, how to explain cure. You are an MD going up to Capitol Hill and going to the White House and talking to people who do not have MDs. Not that you have to have advanced degrees to understand these things, but as a doctor, as somebody very advanced in knowledge of healthcare, how do you explain it to a political class that is not as knowledgeable?
Yeah, it's a challenge. I would make a comment that it may be very useful to have the ministers in Congress rather than the doctors and the lawyers.
Right.
But, it's not so much that you need to explain diagnoses and other technical things, but it is useful for the doctor quotient to have a knowledge of the importance of modern medical care and the difference between modern medical care and medical care run by general practitioners, GPs, in the 1960s, because technology has this sort of poster child of expensive medicine reputation, but the actual fact is that it's highly valuable. So you have to be able to appreciate that, but more than that, sort of understand how medical care is delivered and the nuances of the delivery of medical care, which aren't really nuanced, but they're not part of the daily discussion by people like health economists or certainly lawyers. That needs to be done. I would say that being a doctor does not necessarily give you much knowledge of healthcare policy, mm-hmm. Because that's a very, very different thing. And then on top of that, I would say that I've spoken to the Doctors Caucus in Congress a few times and several individual MDs in the Senate and the House, and they are clearly very valuable in this formation of legislation. But it's a difficult narrative to articulate the so-called conservative case for healthcare reform that I'm talking about here for most people, when the opposite side is so simple. It's a simple marketing slogan, guaranteed free healthcare for all.
Right.
It's a complete lie, really, but it's simple to articulate and it seems very attractive.
Right, thank you. You just led me to my next question. So there was a once upon a time in America, Scott, Democrats could talk about defense. John Kennedy runs for president in 1960 on the missile gap. The late Henry Jackson, the senator from Washington, very strong hawk, created a whole brand of Democrats called Scoop Jackson Democrats, very strong on national security. If you want to bring the next presidential debate to a halt, ask them when they would use military force. They just don't have a good answer on this. Conversely, Republicans struggle, Scott, and they struggle on the language of health care. I've seen Bob Dole get tongue-tied over this when he ran for president. He'd go into gobbledygook legislative speech about markups and bills and things like that. George W. Bush didn't have to run on it. John McCain really didn't have a good answer for it when he ran in 2008. Mitt Romney kind of stumbled around it, in part because he had his experiences in Massachusetts. I don't see Republicans able to speak this language, though, Scott. Why do you think Republicans are tongue-tied when it comes to health care?
You know, I actually have made this point to them very, very frequently, that the biggest problem is articulating the message, and they have done a very poor job articulating the policies. And the reason is it's partly that there's a tremendous amount of mythology, excuse me, about an alternative set of facts that are not facts at all about U.S. healthcare. Being worse than in the rest of the world. And, the other thing is, like I said, the message of the other side, of the liberal single-payer argument, is so simple, it's enticing. So what needs to be done is, first and foremost, our own congressmen and administration officials in healthcare, many of them know quite a bit, but they need to be fully educated on the facts. And the facts are these, that not only is it true what I said about the disease outcomes, but I think you have to look at what the experience is in these other countries with the very models held up as the paradigms of or the goals for our reform. And there's two important points. We ask, who wouldn't want free guaranteed health care? Well, you look at the countries and you see who wouldn't want it. Then the answer is anybody with enough money to get out of those systems. Mm-hmm. Opts to spend even more money on private health care. And we know this for a fact. The most recent data in the UK, about half the people in of Brits who earn £50,000 or more a year buy private health insurance in addition to their current tax burden
right.
for the NHS or they plan on buying it. That's the most recent data. In Sweden, the mother of all welfare reform, welfare programs, countries, 650,000 Swedes who can afford it already buy private insurance, even though they're already paying $20,000 a year by taxes for their nationalized system. So anyone with money enough to circumvent the system opts to circumvent it. Mm-hmm. And why is that? Because of the poor quality, the known poor quality, by the very people who experience those systems. And so there's another major point that is not understood or ever articulated by conservatives. And that is, in those other countries with single-payer systems for decades, their solution to their failures is increasingly to take those tax dollars collected for their nationalized programs and buy private care, sometimes out of their own countries, across borders. I mean, this is an incredible scandal and a gross admission of failure,
right?
Yet it receives no attention here. And I think it's partly because our side of the conservative side of healthcare reform, they don't even know these facts. So I try to write them. I try to articulate them. I mean, you can see in the UK alone, more than £12 billion are spent per year on private healthcare paid by the NHS, I'm talking about, not mm-hmm. paid by individuals, paid by the NHS. I mean, it's really every country that you can think of, Ireland, Italy, the Netherlands, Norway, Spain, Sweden, Denmark, Finland, all with single-payer healthcare, use tax dollars to buy private care because their systems are failures.
Right. This is the Area 45 podcast, so let's wrap up by talking a bit about 45 himself. I am trying to stay out of the predictions business for the next year and a half, Scott, because I spoke way too much about what I thought was going to happen in 2016, and boy, was I wrong. But this much I think is certain. If the economy continues on the current path, if it remains robust, if it remains healthy, if we don't go into a recession or there's a sharp downward turn that really gives Democrats more ammunition to talk about the state of the economy, they're going to have to find something else to talk about. You just can't run on impeachment. You can't run on character. You've got to have some policy chops. You want to be elected president of the United States. And healthcare, Scott, seems like the logical choice. Why? Because, number one, they did it in 2018. It was pretty effective. They went into swing districts. They trashed Republicans for trying to repeal and failing to replace and just saying you can't trust these people with your healthcare. Vote for us. And it worked. But the other reason is because what we just talked about. Republicans stumble all over the topic of healthcare. So you're talking to 45, you're talking to Trump, you're talking to the White House. What's your recommendation for the language that he needs to be putting out on the trail right now? Easy for him to say, well, we'll get a Republican Congress and we'll do it, you know, our way. But what should he be talking about in terms of principles? What should he be talking about in terms of empathy, ensuring that he understands what people are going through?
I think the key here is to make it clear to the American people a couple of points. Number one, the quality of U.S. health care is the best in the world, and it will be lost, unquestionably lost, if we move towards single payer. And we know it will be lost because we look at the single payer systems all over the world, and even in our own country, specifically the VA system, where the solution, again, is moving people to get private care.
Right.
That's point number one. We don't want to lose that. What the health care reform plan of the Trump administration is, actually, is to broaden access to care by getting rid of the blockage that is present in the system that was doubled down on Obamacare, mm-hmm. to getting the care to be cheaper, because cheaper care gets access for poor and middle-class people. Rich people are going to get access to care. That's not the concern here. The reform is that we need to bring down the price of care without killing the quality. And the best way to do that, as everyone knows in the United States, is by competition and getting rid of these anti-consumer harmful regulations. Now, I mean, the goal, I like to say it this way, for Medicaid, which is a substandard insurance program for poor people, unconscionable to celebrate that, the Trump administration should say, listen, we want to get poor people to get into the same medical care that everybody in Congress gets, mm-hmm. that everybody who's got money has access to. And the way to do that is to change that program to a bridge to private insurance and to add competition to bring the prices down. The goal of healthcare reform, I'll say it again, is to broaden access to high quality care for everyone in the United States. And the way to do that is not by top-down regulation. It couldn't be more wrong what the Bernie Sanders, and I'm putting that name in quotes, the Democrat presidential candidates, the Joe Biden proposal, it couldn't be more misguided than what they're saying. They will kill the excellence of American healthcare.
I know you don't like to do predictions, but Scott, in a world where, let's say in the off chance that Obamacare is ruled unconstitutional, so now Congress has to find a replacement if they want to find a replacement, and let's say you have the same lineup in 2021 that you have right now, Republican Senate, Democratic House, how do those two sides get together? Because it seems to me that a Republican Senate and the Democratic House right now have precious little common ground when it comes to health care.
Yeah, I'm, you know, that's a very tough question, because although the ideas are clear, and I have my own six-point health care reform proposal that goes into detail, there are alternative proposals that are very good, and they are based on the sort of principles I have articulated here. The reality, the political reality, is very different. I don't think anyone would say that the Democrats and the Republicans are going to pass major legislation on health care. Mm-hmm. I don't think there is any chance that anything that could be conceived of or interpreted of as a victory for President Trump will be passed by the Democratic House. So I think there will be stopgap measures. There will be sort of like these budget temporary measures that are passed, and nothing really will get done in a substantive way until after the election. And if then, if we have a split government, it's going to be difficult to get major legislation through.
It's a great what-if to ponder, because politically, Republicans have to do something with these people enrolled in Obamacare. If Obamacare is no more, you just can't leave those people hanging on the vine. They need health care. Conversely, you can't let the opportunity pass to say, well, wait a second, if we're going to continue Obamacare, we've got to make some fixes. But then the question is, what fixes could they take the Democratic House and the Democratic House be willing to do? So, you know, in theory, the two sides should be able to work together, but hey, Congress is pretty dysfunctional these days.
Yes, it is. And you'll notice, by the way, that until Biden spoke up about saying he doesn't want to get rid of Obamacare, there was no mention by the Democrats about preserving Obamacare. That's because it's acknowledged as a gross failure. I mean, it's factually true that it created higher unaffordable premiums for private insurance. It created less access to doctors by those private insurance policies. Mm-hmm. It saddled American taxpayers with a gross misuse of funds by expanding a substandard system like Medicaid. They're not running to preserve Obamacare. The only one who is really is Biden, and I think that's an untenable position, because he's already made the biggest probable political error that he could have by saying, if you want to keep Obamacare, you can keep it, reminding everybody about the false promises of keeping your doctor and your insurance.
But he's twixt and tween, Scott. He understands the problems of Obamacare, but he and Obama are linked, and he needs Barack Obama. He needs Barack Obama's voters to get the nomination, so he can't throw Obamacare under the bus.
Absolutely, and that's his dilemma, and we'll see if it succeeds. I have my doubts.
Okay. What are you working on these days? You have another book coming up?
I'm actually revising, it's funny you should mention that, because I'm just beginning the revision of my healthcare reform proposal to update it, to focus and address directly head on things like drug prices, and update some numbers, because we have even more numbers that people need to be aware of, the evidence about what socialized medicine leads to and how it really is something that no one who looks at evidence to formulate policy would move toward.
Good stuff. Scott Atlas, I enjoyed the conversation.
Same here, Bill. Thank you.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States, in this case, what to do about health care. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word, get your friends to have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for Hoover's Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Hoover's fellows, including Scott Atlas, straight to your inbox every weekday. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is at Hoover Inst. That's at Hoover, I-N-S-T. Scott Atlas, M.D., is also on Twitter. His Twitter handle is at S.W. Atlas Hoover. Let me spell that out. That's at S.W. A-T-L-A-S-H-O-O-V-E-R, at S.W. Atlas Hoover. I also recommend you check out his bio page on Hoover's website, and do yourself a favor and pop over to Hoover Press, which is also on the Hoover website, and check out his books. What better reading for a long plane ride, time at the beach, time in the mountains, time you just want to zone out during the summer. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. As always, thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on iTunes, iTunes U, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. I'm Chris Dauer for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.